Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Gopi Jana Balabha Giravarir Hari. Gopi Jana Balabha Giravarir Hari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanacharya. Yamuna Tira Vanacharya. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jai Om Vishnupad Parabhamsa Parabhrajakachara Sotir Sita Shri Shimana's Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Antigod Vaishnavinda Ki Jai. All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Guranga. Nama Om Vishnu Paraya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tinamane Namaste Sarasvati Mgoravana Bicharni Nivishesha Srinivadi Paskatari Sitarani. So, we're reading today from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 56, and the title of today's lecture is Krishna Protects His Devotees. So, we're going to repeat here. Sarva karmani pi sada kurvano madhyapashraya mat prasadaravapnoti shashvatam paramhavyayam. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Though engaged in all kinds of activities, my pure devotee, under my protection, reaches the eternal and imperishable abode by my grace. Purport. The word mud vyapashraya means under the protection of the Supreme Lord. To be free from material contamination, a pure devotee acts under the direction of the Supreme Lord or his representative, the spiritual master. There is no time limitation for a pure devotee. He was always 24 hours a day, 100%, engaged in activities under the direction of the Supreme Lord. To a devotee who is thus engaged in Krishna consciousness, the Lord is very, very kind. In spite of all difficulties, he is eventually placed in the transcendental abode, or Krishna Loka. He is guaranteed entrance there. There is no doubt about it. In that supreme abode, there is no change. Everything is eternal, imperishable, and full of knowledge. So the theme today is that through our service, our devotion, and our surrender to God, He will give all protection to His devotees. This is something, of course, that is very important to everyone, very important to the devotees. And I think this is a theme you find in many religions, this idea that God is protecting, that God is there, that He is not in all religions, of course, but in many religions, that God is a person who gives personal care and personal protection to those who follow Him. So we want to discuss how God will protect us, not just materially, but also spiritually, which is even more important. First, one might ask, well, why do we need protection from God? People might think there are many other places one might seek protection from family members, from the government, from the police, from the military. So many different people may give protection. Or some people maybe think that one should just be self-reliant. I know my father, who was pretty much a determined atheist, he felt, well, religion is a crutch for people who are weak. You know, if you're weak and you just don't have any strength of your own, then you have to turn to religion. But of course, we know that this is ignorance. but at any rate, don't want to speak about the dead. But what is wrong with this? Well, first of all, there is so much in this world we need protection from. There's danger at every step, as it is said in the Vedas. We find that our world is becoming increasingly a place of danger. It's even frightening. And we seem to be less and less able to predict and control events around us. I was reading some statistics that in the last 3,421 years of recorded history, I don't know who comes up with these things, only 268 years were without wars. And in the 5,000 years of recorded time, there have been 14,531 wars. So, yeah, this is a dangerous place. And it doesn't seem to be getting a lot better, does it? Now, this degradation that we find at this time and place was actually predicted 5,000 years ago in the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the 12th canto, talking about how Kali Yuga, this age that we're in, is called the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And that's what we find. Fighting, quarrel, it's the nature of people. Hypocrisy, so much cheating, lying. Very hard to find honest discourse anymore. In the 12th canto, chapter 3, verses 7 and 8, it says, "For the sake of conquering me, materialistic persons fight one another. Fathers oppose their sons. Brothers fight one another because their hearts are bound to possessing political power. Political leaders challenge one another. All this land is mine. It is not yours, you fool. Thus they attack one another and die." This is 5,000 years ago. It sounds like today, doesn't it? And, of course, we know that the description of our leaders is predicted. And it's very, very clear about lying, hypocrisy, those who are only interested in their own power and not really interested in taking care of those under their charge. So we see that everywhere today. And religious qualities are becoming more and more scarce, and the ungodly become predominant. Now, not just on a national scale or an international scale, we find in our own lives, in our individual lives, there's a great deal of suffering, of illness, of tragedies. People may be thinking they're doing very well in the world. They may have a certain amount of wealth. They may have a good position. So many things are going well for them, perhaps good in their family life. And then there's some illness or some tragedy or some suffering comes about, and it's unpredictable. And then where do people turn? Of course, people often turn to science and medicine, thinking that they're going to give them some relief, give them some help, going to make everything work out well. And we see that science can rightfully be proud of a certain amount of prolonging life to some extent. Many of the plagues and infectious diseases of the past are gone. You know, in the year 1900, what the main causes of death were? Smallpox, influenza, tuberculosis, malaria. These things are pretty much gone. And now we have heart conditions, heart disease, cancer. So it's like we trade one thing for another. You know, in fact, so it's like it just seems to be a revolving cycle of what's the latest thing that's going to cause pain and suffering to the human condition. So this is part of human life. And it's something that we've all tend to pretty much get used to, and we just expect it, we count on it. But most people either try not to think about the things that might cause difficulty, or they're in great fear of these. But the problem is, we are meant for higher consciousness. We are meant for thinking of spiritual life, of spiritual goals. And if there's too much fear, defense, too much struggle, it's very difficult to pursue spiritual life. So there needs to be a balance, you know, where people can live peacefully in such a way that they can actually concentrate on what is really important, which is our spiritual life. So we have to ultimately depend upon God. We can't really depend upon our scientists, our leaders, etc. to protect us. Because ultimately, everyone gets old, everyone gets diseased, everyone dies, and everyone takes birth again. This is the cycle of life that everybody endures. Now, when we say you have to depend on God, of course one uses one intelligence. We don't stand in the busy road and say, Krishna, protect me from getting hit by the cars. We're not foolish. Prabhupada gave the example. He said, we don't say, oh, a tiger, come and eat me. You know, Krishna will protect me. No, we don't treat God as our order supplier. You know, it's like, I can do any foolish thing and you have to come and save me now or protect me. No, that's not the attitude. Our attitude is one of how do we serve God? How do we love God? Not how we put him to the test of his protection. But ultimately we realize that protection, that love, that real friendship can only come from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When one is spiritually realized, we understand that we are different from this body. We are different from this mind. Both the gross and the subtle body are there. But the soul, the spirit within us, that is separate. And when we understand that, when there's some realization of the spirit within us, then that brings about fearlessness. There is less concern, there's less fear for what happens to this outer cage of the material body, this outer dress, if we understand that the reality is the spiritual experience that is within us, and that is indirectly in relationship, in love with God. So we call this fear of death that comes from identification of the body false ego. In other words, we all have an identity. We all have we all are persons. We all are individuals. But the real individuality is spiritual individuality, not this particular body that I happen to be living in at the present moment. So we want to overcome that. Srimad Bhagavatam 3:26-16 says, the influence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is felt in the time factor, which causes fear of death due to the false ego of the deluded soul who has contacted material nature. So basically, if we really understood and believed and realized that we were not the external body, we would have no fear of death because we would understand the eternality of the soul, that continues despite whatever is happening externally. Now, yet, nobody particularly wants to see the body end because that's actually natural. The desire for immortality is natural because the soul is eternal. Our very nature is to be eternal. Therefore, the idea of death is repugnant to us. It's not something that is natural to us at all. The problem is that we're misidentifying who we are. We're misidentifying the self with the body. And therefore, we become very fearful for the loss of the body, when we should be trying to focus upon understanding the real soul within. It says that Krishna is Amrita. He is deathless, and the devotees are also deathless. Bhagavatam 2:16-19 says, deathlessness, fearlessness, freedom from anxieties of old age and disease exist in the kingdom of God. So that's what this verse is saying in the Bhagavad Gita. It's saying that the devotee who surrenders to Krishna, who receives his protection, goes back to him and enjoys that immortality in the spiritual world. Krishna does not say, you're going to be immortal in this material world. You're going to live forever here and everything is going to go wonderfully for you here in the material world. That's just not the way it is. It's not the way this material world is designed or made. But the spiritual world is. Yes, there is a place of perfection, but it's not here. It's in Krishna Loka, it's in the spiritual world, in the spiritual kingdom. And that is something that Krishna is telling us, this is where we will go. This is where he will bring us. He gives us that assurance. So the devotee feels under the personal protection and guidance of Krishna. In the purport to this verse, 2:16-19, Srila Prabhupada says, situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's personal protection. When a living entity is fully surrendered, he is under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him the intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization. So the real protection that Krishna gives us is helping us to advance in spiritual life and come back to Him. And so we see in many, many great devotees, we have examples in the Bhagavatam and our other Vedic literatures, how these devotees have surrendered to Krishna and been protected by Him in all circumstances. One of our best examples, of course, is demonstrated by Prahlad Maharaj, who as a young child dealt with unimaginable adversity, where his father tried to kill him, his own father, in so many different ways, but his faith never wavered. Krishna always protected him in every circumstance. Even though he never even directly asked for help, he just chanted the holy name, prayed to Krishna, depended upon Krishna, and was given complete protection. So he demonstrated this a symptom of surrender, of being fully dependent on the Lord and expecting His protection. This is one of the six symptoms of surrender that we see. So it's a great lesson for a devotee, how one can develop one's faith and to depend upon Krishna. Now at this point, we might ask, at least I would probably be asking, is this realistic? Does this only apply to those who are these great surrendered souls in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and does it actually apply to us? I'm not a pure devotee. Will Krishna give me this protection he gave to Prahlad Maharaj or the Pandavas or to Draupadi? Or we can go down seeing so many different examples of how devotees were protected. Now, one thing that's interesting is in this verse, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, one of our great acharyas, he also wrote a commentary in Bhagavad Gita. And on this particular verse, his commentary notes that this word ashrayate, that Srila Prabhupada called it engaged in all kind of activities. What kind of activities? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says it means both what are seemingly material as well as spiritual. So sometimes devotees often ask this. People say, okay, I have to go to work, I'm doing a job, I'm taking care of my family. You know, is this spiritual? Where's the spiritual activity in this? I understand chanting and reading and coming to the temple and worshiping deities is spiritual, but what about all of this? Well, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and also Bhaktivinoda Thakur also talks about this in some of his works like Sri Krishna Samhita and others, that those things that we do as far as our family life and taking care of our body and all those necessities, these are called secondary spiritual duties, where the cheering and the chanting are sadhana as primary spiritual duties. So we have a balance of these. As long as we keep the primary spiritual duties there prominent, then of course we have to do these other things. It's part of being in this material world for most of us, unless one is a complete renunciate. Vishwanath also says there's a difference between karma mixed with bhakti and bhakti with a little bit of karma. So in other words, bhakti is the devotee's primary engagement. Our primary interest, our primary activity is engagement in Krishna conscious activities and spiritual activities. And we also have to do these other activities, but we do them in the consciousness of service, in the consciousness that Krishna is ultimately the reason behind, the purpose, the beneficiary of everything we do. Thank you for using the time. I had one. So even in the neophyte position, which is all of us, we begin to take shelter of Krishna. How do we do this? As soon as we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're taking shelter of Krishna, aren't we? First, we take shelter of the holy name. That's the process in Kali Yuga that Lord Chaitanya has given us, to take shelter of the Sankirtan movement of chanting Hare Krishna. This is the beginning. This is taking shelter of Krishna. Srila Prabhupada told us that you could say the working definition of the Hare Krishna mantra is, O my dear Krishna, O Radharani, energy of Krishna, please engage me in your devotional service. So right there, we're taking shelter of Krishna, and we gain his protection in that way. So this doesn't mean that the devotee does not ever experience material suffering. That's the nature of this material world. This material world, by its very, very nature, its very definition, means suffering. But the attachment to the material body becomes broken gradually. And as we become less attached and less identifying with the body, then the sufferings of the body affect us less. And we're able to understand our spiritual existence and spiritual reality, despite whatever's going on with the body. So, of course, relief from material suffering is a symptom of devotional service. That's one of the six symptoms of devotional service that's given in the beginning of the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu of the Nectar Devotion. The very first one is kleshagni, relief from the sufferings of this material world. So we do experience that. We experience spiritual happiness within our relationship with Krishna, and we see a great mitigation of suffering in so many ways. So sometimes the question is asked, often I would say the question is asked, why do we still sometimes experience suffering? And think, okay, I'm surrendered to God, I'm trying to be Krishna conscious, I'm chanting, I'm a devotee. Why do I still experience physical difficulties, mental difficulties, different types of suffering? Well, there's a few good reasons for that, actually, that our scriptures and our acharyas have talked about. Now, first of all, there are reactions to past sinful activities. We all have who knows how many lifetimes of karma behind us. And while that suffering is relieved, it is a somewhat gradual process. Prabhupada gave the example of the fan. Told this one many times, the fan winding down. The fan is turning, you pull the electric plug, and it gradually slows down. So in the same way, and this is described by Rupa Goswami and Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, how the progression of sinful reactions is winding down, is ending one by one. Those that are from the future, those that are from the past, there's four different categories that are all basically ending for the devotee. But it takes a little bit of time. It may not happen immediately. The other thing to understand is that it is not ordinary karma for the devotee, because Krishna is dealing individually and personally with his devotee in a loving relationship. So even though those reactions may be there, they're handled personally and individually. And as far as minimization, Prabhupada talks about this in the teachings of Queen Kunti in chapter 8. Prabhupada says, Karmani nirdhati kintu na bhakti bhajam, from the Brahma Samhita 554. The sufferings of those who engage in devotional service in Krishna consciousness are minimized. For example, one may have been destined to be killed. Instead of being killed with a knife, he may instead get some little cut on his finger. In that way, for one who engages in devotional service, the reactions of past activities are minimized. So I always try to think of this whenever I cut myself all the time or hurt myself like that all the time. You know, I was probably meant to have something much worse happen to me, but by Krishna's grace, just a small, token punishment is there. The other thing is that Krishna sometimes puts us as devotees into difficulty for our own advancement. Now, how do difficulties help us in advancement? Well, it helps us to surrender. It helps us to remember Krishna often. It helps us to learn many things. Many of these things become lessons for us in our lives. We've all probably experienced this, where something that seemed very negative happened to us, and as we reflected upon it years later or a few months later, we sort of understood it. It made some sense. We see why it happened, and maybe even something beneficial or some purpose, for why that happened to us. When we get put in danger or difficulty, it is an opportunity to surrender and to remember Krishna. Often when everything is going well, it's very easy to forget Krishna, isn't it? Think, oh, everything's good, and it's probably due to all my good qualities, that everything is going well, right? Then something goes bad, when we're feeling bad, then we blame Krishna. Why is he doing this to me? That's kind of our nature, the nature of the living entity. We want to blame Krishna for the bad and take credit for the good. In reality, neither is exactly true. So one who knows Krishna, his spiritual fearlessness and strength will grow, his awareness of Krishna's protection will increase, and one can become peaceful, even in this material world. We consider distress that we're experiencing, the devotee says, that it's part of his own misdeeds and sees it minimized. And of course, we have this very wonderful prayer by Lord Brahma, 10.14.8, that Srila Prabhupada said, this should be the motto of all devotees. It's such an important verse. Tate nukampam so samikshamano. My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. There's a very wonderful commentary on this verse by Vishwanathacharya Thakur, which is very much like, there's another commentary on in the Bhagavatam 10.88.8, which is a very, very important verse. This is the one about why Lord Vishnu's devotees are very poor and Lord Shiva's devotees are very rich. You know, this, I think Maharaj Prickett was asking that. So that answer kind of led into this, why devotees will sometimes experience difficulty. Vishwanathacharya Thakur says, a devotee understands that the happiness and distress he undergoes due to performing bhakti and committing aparadhas are special mercy from the Lord. It is like the father who sometimes makes his child drink milk and sometimes makes him drink bitter neem juice. The bitter neem juice is, of course, medicine. So sometimes he gives him milk, it's very nice, and sometimes the bitter neem juice is medicinal for when the child is sick. Sometimes the father embraces and kisses his son, and sometimes he beats him. This is a different time, obviously. We don't do that anymore. The devotee accepts whatever happens to him as the arrangement of the Lord acting for his benefit. The devotee thinks, the Lord certainly knows what is best for me. Even if I don't know, karma and time have no effect on the devotee. So this is Krishna's personal arrangement for me. Out of his mercy, Krishna sometimes gives me happiness and sometimes gives me distress, considering how to engage me in his service. So here, the parent gives the child milk when everything is nice, and then the sick child gets the bitter medicine. Now, the parent equally loves the child in either case, right? If he's giving the medicine or if he's giving him some sweet or something that he likes. The child may not appreciate that, right? The child cannot understand the parent's love and well wishes when he gets the medicine that doesn't taste good. So we're very much like that. Krishna is always acting for the good of the devotee, and sometimes it feels like we're getting sweet balls, and sometimes it feels like we're getting bitter neem juice. You know, but we don't understand because we're just like a child. You know, our vision, our cosmic view is quite limited. We can't understand things on the scale that Krishna has seen. Krishna has seen, you know, the entire scope of reality, seen everybody's interactions, everybody's needs, everybody's growth, everybody's learning. And what is Krishna's motivation? Does he want to punish us? No. We do not see Krishna as an angry, punishing God. Maya can be angry and punishing, but Krishna is the loving father of his devotees, and he wants to lead us to come back to him, to surrender to him, and develop our loving relationship with him. It's hard to assess motivation to God. How can we do that? It's almost presumptuous. Say, oh, I know what motivates God. No, of course. But he tells us from the scriptures and the acharyas, we can get some idea, some concept of it. And what we hear, what we understand, particularly in works like Bhaktisandarbha by Jiva Goswami, Bhaktisamrita Sindhu, that Krishna's motivation is to increase prema, love, pure loving devotional service. This is what Krishna wants. And he has an insatiable, complete, you know, inexhaustible ability and capacity for love. Think about how many living entities there are. Billions upon billions just on this planet. And Krishna wants every single one of them to be in a loving relationship with him. Sometimes we might think, well, this almost seems fanciful. You know, or like, how can Krishna do this? Well, we know that Krishna is within every single living entity. Along with us is the Supersoul. Through so many lifetimes, he's able to expand himself that way. So certainly he can expand himself in loving relationships with every single devotee, with every single living entity. And we see, and we know he does this in the spiritual world. You know, he expands easily 16,108 times for all his wives in Dwarka. I don't know. I see different figures. I'm not quite sure how many gopis there were. Was it a billion or 10 billion? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a lot. And Krishna is able to expand himself in relationship with every single one of them. So he has unlimited capacity for love, and that's really what his plan is. That's what he does. He wants to engage in these loving relationships with every single one of us. So sometimes the material world may not seem so good, and we may think, oh, why Krishna? Why is this happening to me? It's all happening to bring us back to him, as Prabhupada was saying at the end of this purport, to bring us back to the spiritual world. So we can't always understand it. Another couple examples of this I wanted to give. Prabhupada gives the example of the kitten in the mouth of the cat, or the rat in the mouth of the cat. It looks the same, right? But Prabhupada says, for the kitten, it's the loving, you know, caring of the mother. For the rat, it's certain death. And it looks the same, but very, very different. So that's the difference between devotee and non-devotee, about one who is in a loving relationship with Krishna and one who isn't. I think another way of understanding this, I like this example. I don't know, I thought of it. I don't know if it's in any scripture or not. But it's, think about the difference between the mechanics, the mechanistic nature of karma, and the personal nature of Krishna's dealing. Okay, take a rubber ball, and I bounce it on the wall, and it bounces back. It's very mechanical, right? It's going to be, depending upon the angle that it hits, the angle that comes back, a certain trajectory, it's going to, mechanically, that ball is going to return to me. Now think if I toss the ball to somebody, and they toss the ball back to me. That's the difference. Ordinary karma is just like the ball, you know, action and reaction of karma. Krishna, something we call Krishna karma, or, you know, dealing with Krishna is personal. We're tossing the ball, and Krishna's tossing the ball back to us in a way that is for our benefit, for our learning, and for our advancement in Krishna consciousness. So Krishna acts for the best of his devotee. He always gives his protection. And the devotee accepts that everything is coming for Krishna for his good. There's one more verse that I like. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam 11:20, 27 and 28. Having awakened faith in the narrations of my glories, being disgusted with all material activities, knowing that all sense gratification leads to misery, but still being unable to renounce all sense enjoyment, my devotees should remain happy and worship me with great faith and conviction. Even though he is sometimes engaged in sense enjoyment, my devotee knows that all sense gratification leads to a miserable result, and he sincerely repents such activities. I particularly like this verse because it's Krishna speaking, and Krishna is recognizing the plight of the conditioned soul, of how we are all struggling in this material world. He understands that. But he knows that we are trying, that we are trying to engage in Krishna consciousness, even though sometimes we're not always successful. Sometimes there may be some material desires. Sometimes sense gratification is still there. But what is the attitude of the devotee? He knows, we know that sense gratification will not lead to any good. We know this is not in our best interest. We try to renounce it, and we repent such activities. So all that separates us from pure devotion, pure prema, love from God, is that we don't always have complete faith in Christian spiritual life. And we do, and we tend to maintain faith in material happiness, that there may be still something there, there may still be a little bit of enjoyment, maybe something I can still squeeze out, you know, out of this material world. We keep trying, don't we? But that faith increases. As we continue as devotees, year after year, and those of us who have been around about 50 years, most of us, if we're still around, would probably say that our faith has definitely increased. If nothing else, our faith increases because we've had enough experience in life that we know that Krishna's there, and Krishna's there for us, and Krishna is helping us all the time. And faith is built by association with devotees. It's based upon our faith in the spiritual master and following his instructions. It's nourished by the processes of hearing and chanting, serving the deity, etc. And in that way, we continue on more and more, and as Krishna becomes pleased, as Srila Prabhupada becomes pleased, then, you know, our journey back home, back to Godhead, becomes assured. Okay? So thank you all very much. I actually ended on time for a change. Okay. Hare Krishna. Comments, questions?
Thank you for your class. You were talking about the misidentifying with the body.
I'm sorry?
You were talking about misidentifying with the body.
Yeah.
That idea was easier for me thinking about misidentifying with my own body. When it comes to losing somebody close, then it's a more difficult idea. Can you speak a little bit about like applying this philosophy with grief?
I don't know if I understand the question very well. I didn't hear it. What is it?
He lost his best friend.
You lost your best friend.
He's from Bhaktivinoda. So he's asking you to explain, say the question.
In other words, if one has a loss like that, how does one understand it?
Yeah.
Well, it can mean many...
How do you agree?
It can mean many things, and there's not a simple answer. And we all experience grief, you know, in different ways, even though we know we're not the body and we know that we're the spirit soul and we know that whoever we lost, they have an eternal, you know, spirit soul that continues onward. That doesn't mean that we don't experience loss and pain, and we have to all come to grips with that in different ways. And but it will happen. It happens, you know, it happens over time if one approaches it in the right way. You know, I do some grief counseling, and I just want to say that there's an old slogan that, you know, time heals all wounds. Well, it doesn't necessarily. You know, time can be helpful if there is a process in place where one is beginning to understand. So, I mean, I could talk to you a lot more about this maybe, you know, personally, but generally we need to somehow come to an understanding. And so that we can place that event within our lives in such a way that we make meaning out of it and are able to continue on in our spiritual life. And this Krishna conscious philosophy gives us the best possible way to understand loss, because it's going to be there in the material world. And we know that it's going to be there. We're all going to experience it. When you get to my age, see, my friends are all starting to die off now. I mean, seriously. You know, it's... So, you know, we all experience those things. And they're not easy. And we do feel it. We're not insentient. You know, we're not stone. But at the same time, we get through it because we have that higher understanding. We have the philosophical context, you know, of understanding how the material world works, how our spiritual life works, how that person's soul will continue on, and that's why one reason it's so important. I don't know if this person was a devotee or not, but it's why it's so important that we try to give everyone we know some Krishna consciousness, right? Because that's going to help assure their next lifetime that they get an opportunity, you know, for a better life and for devotional service. And that's why, I mean, even with like our family members and people we know or people at work and like that, it's always, you know, so important that we give people prasadam or some way they can chant and hear the holy name or get a book or things like that. Anyway, it's a big topic. I don't know if we can cover it all right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Ruth? Oh, get you next. Right. See, checking in.
Thank you for the great class, Prabhu. You were saying how this world is not where we come from. It's not where we're meant to be, this material world.
Yeah.
What about the concept of bringing heaven to earth? of bridging that gap of heaven and earth. And also as devotees, we kind of Krishnize material energy. So
yeah.
In a sense, can we not feel at home in this world in a certain level if we bring heaven to earth together?
Well, yeah, particularly in former ages. This is Kali Yuga, and it's difficult. You know, it's difficult to spiritualize everything because just everything is working against it in a sense. However, the concept is there. It's called Yukta Vairagya, how we use everything. We use the material energy in Krishna's service, and that spiritualizes it, which is what we actually do in the process of Krishna consciousness all the time, isn't it? You know, in other words, it's explained by our acharyas how we use the material mind, we use the material intelligence, we use the voice, we use our bodies, we use all of these material things in Krishna's service, and then therefore they become spiritual. So yes, we could conceivably, and in fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, third chapter, I think it's verse 11, 12, along there, where it's talking about in the beginning of, you know, creation, you know, the generations of men and demigods came forth, and Krishna said, be thou happy by the sacrifice. And Prabhupada talks about in the purport that the purpose of human life is to be peaceful and happy in this material world, and then afterwards go home back to Godhead. So if we had a God-conscious civilization, if everyone was acting piously and we weren't accruing, you know, heaps of bad karma through cow killing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, yes, we could have almost like a heavenly planet here on Earth. Now, of course, if you really want that, you can do a lot of good, pious deeds and go to a heavenly planet. That's also there. But it's not the spiritual world. It's still not the spiritual world.
And when we can Krishnize material energy or use material energy in Krishna's service, that's not only external, that could also be internal. Like I have internal material energy that I can Krishnize internally and kind of spiritualize my internal world.
Absolutely.
Because I feel mental health is a great way to qualify how good quality of life you have.
Yeah.
And if you don't spiritualize or Krishnize your mental health, it's not going to work.
All right. Good point. Thank you. Anything on the lady's side? I want to make sure. Okay. Was there? No?
Here. Do the ladies want the microphone? Oh, okay. First, Lord Chaitanya, thank you for being here. Lord Nityananda. Prabhu, thank you for being here. You're always a sage, and you're very kind. One thing I want to say to you is I lost my mother 12 years ago and took care of her through cancer for many, many, many months. And I cried for over a month. I mean, it was like something was being ripped away from me. However, yes, time heals all wounds. Or as John Lennon said, time wounds all heals. And but the point I'm trying to say is the comfort for you will be is that you know, I finally woke up to the fact she doesn't have to take care of me anymore. She's free. She's totally free. I'm not a burden and I'm not a help to her anymore because she doesn't need me anymore. And she's back to where Krishna wants her. So if that's a comfort to you, I just want to let you know your friend is with Krishna. Your friend is free. Your friend has moved on. And we all move on, every single solitary one of us. And I just want to say to the people here at ISKCON Alachua, I moved here 12 years ago. It's been a healing experience. It hasn't been perfect. But I just want to say to see Krishna when we can is a comfort. And to know that these people who leave us, they're free. They're totally free of everything. And so with that in mind, I just want to say again, Lord Chaitanya, I'm looking forward to the celebration next week. I hope we all are. And all the Prabhus and the Matajis here, I just want to say thankful for your kindness.
Okay, thank you very much for that. By the way, I was thinking in terms of celebrating the appearance of Shri Shri Gaurini Thai in Gainesville 50 years ago. I actually was here. Some of us were in Miami Temple, and we came up for that. I didn't come forward to speak about it because 50 years ago, I don't remember it. I know I was here, but I don't remember any details. Except I remember Amarendra telling us when you cut up a course, you weren't supposed to cut them, just break the flowerlets off. It was almost like a sinful thing, you know, to cut a cauliflower. Anyway, Amarendra was a very interesting temple president. Wonderful. Okay, anything else?
I have one technical clarification. Hmm. You have quoted 11.20.27.28.
Yeah.
Yes, beautiful verse. I always wonder, like, does Krishna experience when some soul is suffering, or Krishna just knows about it, he hears about it when that soul prays, or really he feels like the soul feeling because he doesn't escort the material nature? So I was just curious, like, little doubt is there, like, how much Krishna really experience our suffering.
There's a long passage by Jiva Goswami in the Bhaktisiddhanta, I can show it to you, where he discusses this specifically. And just a quick answer to question, Krishna does not experience suffering in the material world, because Krishna is completely aloof, because Krishna is pure, Krishna is completely spiritual, therefore he cannot actually experience the suffering, but he knows it. In other words, he created everything, he knows everything, he's everywhere, he understands it, he knows it, but he doesn't experience the suffering, therefore, that is why he uses the devotees to be the conduit of his mercy to the conditioned soul. Now, he, of course, shows his mercy to devotees, and he has a relationship, but for the non-devotees, he sends the Vaishnavas. He sends the guru, the spiritual masters, to pick up those souls, because Jiva Goswami describes it that they still have some more understanding, being part of, you know, in other words, being in, I mean, they're completely spiritual, but being, I guess, closer to the situation, or being human or whatever, you know, being in that, they're able to have that compassion. So we see that Prahlad Maharaj, we see, Vasudev Dutt, we see so many of them who had such complete compassion for the conditioned souls, you know. And of course, Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda also did, because they were playing the role of a devotee, not as the role of God, right? So you see that compassion, which is exhibited by the Vaishnavas and by the devotees primarily, and that's Krishna's technique, or that's Krishna's instrument in bringing back the conditioned souls and showing mercy to them.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So it's a difference between understanding the suffering and feeling the suffering.
Would you say, because they are relative truth, not absolute truth, but in a sense that they can relate, the Vaishnavas or the devotees, so their prescription probably more important than Krishna's prescription, in one sense.
What is more important?
The prescription or the instruction. Like Prabhupada's instruction to his follower is probably most important.
Right. Actually, the most important instruction is instruction of your guru. Right.
Yes.
Of course, the guru is completely in line with Krishna. So in one sense, it's non-different. But yes, the mercy goes through the guru, through parampara, to Krishna. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.